Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 2nd, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the most detailed snapshot of early hominid life, the origins of community structure, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the upsides of recessions, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For many generations, including those of Charles Darwin and Thomas Huxley, scientists have been searching for fossil evidence of our last common ancestor with other primates. More recently, by comparing DNA, scientists have learned that our closest living relative is the chimpanzee. But of course, that doesn't mean we evolved from chimpanzees. Tim White is a paleontologist at the University of California, Berkeley.
We have no good reason to assume that we evolved while chimps didn't, and that the common ancestor was some kind of a chimpanzee. It was a common ancestor. We want to find out what it was. That's why we do paleontology.
And now, in 11 papers in this week's Science, White, along with 46 colleagues, present the fossils, data, and analysis of Ardipithecus ramidus, or Ardi, the oldest known skeleton of a hominid, a potential human ancestor.
What we're seeing here is something that we never could have predicted from either a modern human or a modern chimpanzee. The only way to learn about this creature is through the paleontological record.
That record shows that Ardi lived 4.4 million years ago, making it around a million years older than Australopithecus afarensis, the Lucy species.
We are another step closer to the last common ancestor we shared with the African apes. And so Ardi allows us to look at Australopithecus in a different perspective, but it also allows us to look back and have a new perspective on that last common ancestor we shared with chimpanzees.
Well, we've sort of known about this skeleton for, 15 years.
Andrew Hill is a paleontologist at Yale University. While the initial find of Ardipithecus was published 15 years ago, it's taken White's team this long to unearth all the fossils, reconstruct Ardi's bones, and analyze the skeleton and all the associated data.
And it's been worth the wait because it's very interesting. It's unexpected, as most new fossil finds are. But in the same way, it fits quite nicely in the context of other things that we know about. But it's not something you'd have easily predicted.
What you might not have easily predicted, according to Anne Gibbons, is that our last common ancestor was not even something that was chimpanzee-like. Gibbons is sciences correspondent on human evolution and author of The First Human.
In these 11 papers, they make a case over and over again, based on many different parts of Ardipithecus ramidus' anatomy, that the common ancestor was not like a chimpanzee or a gorilla. That knuckle walking and all these traits we think of as being very chimpy-like, chimpanzee-like traits or gorilla-like, are the results of lots of evolution in chimpanzees and gorillas, that they've changed as much as we have since we had an ancestor with them 6, 7, 8 million years ago.
Now, 6, 7, 8 million years ago is much further back than Ardipithecus ramidus at 4.4 million years ago. But because the team unearthed more than 100 pieces of a single skeleton, including parts of the head, arms, hands, pelvis, legs, and feet, as well as fossils of many other Ardipithecus to compare them with, White says that means we can learn even about Ardi's social structure and how it, too, was different from that of modern chimpanzees.
In fact, you wouldn't have recognized it as a chimpanzee had you seen it. It lacked the knuckle-walking specializations that we see in chimpanzees. It lacked specializations for aggression and a particular mating practice that modern chimpanzees have. It lacked the specializations toward frugivory. It shows that all those things arose independently in the chimpanzee, and we have never been chimpanzee-like in those specializations. Instead, we each evolved from a last common ancestor that was a primate that can only be retrieved from the fossil record. We haven't found that yet, but right now, Ardipithecus takes us closer than we've ever been.
But you wouldn't have recognized Ardipithecus ramidus as being much like a modern human, either. Again, scientist Ann Gibbons.
The most significant ways that Ardipithecus ramidus differs from chimpanzees and humans is that it is living in the trees and it's walking upright. Now, the walking upright is one of the key defining traits of being a member of the human family. But then when they look at the foot, it also has a grasping big toe. So it was still climbing and spending time in the trees, probably sleeping in the trees, escaping predators, probably eating in the trees. But it's not swinging through the trees like a chimpanzee. It doesn't have adaptations in the arm that would allow it to swing under the branches. Instead, it was probably walking on top of the branches, holding, doing careful climbing as it moved.
And that challenges yet another notion of what our early ancestor was assumed to be, living in the savanna. But instead of evolving and moving out of the forest and starting to walk upright in the African grasslands, where there aren't many trees, Project co-director Tim White says all lines of evidence lead to the conclusion that Artie lived and died, a forager and an omnivore, in a woodland habitat.
Artie lived 4.4 million years ago on a very flat floodplain where sediments accumulated. And in that horizon that Artie was found, we also have the remains of over 6,000 other vertebrates. We have enough evidence from those animals, from their context, to say that Artie inhabited a woodland habitat. We have gone not just to the Artie fossils, and you can go to those fossils and look at the tooth wear, as my colleague Gen Sua in Tokyo has done. You can look at the isotopic composition of the dental enamel, as my colleague Stan Ambrose in Illinois has done. We can look not just at Ardipithecus, we can look at the monkeys, as my colleagues Steve Frost and Leslie Alesco have done. Colleagues all over the world from many different countries have gone in and examined the data very carefully. Data not just from the vertebrates, but we also have snails. We have fossil wood, fossil seeds. We have fossil millipedes. We have birds. We have very small mammals. And all of these very sensitive environmental indicators build up to a picture of a woodland habitat that's now been sampled just by geological forces where the exposures of this ancient horizon are present. It used to be very different from what it is today. It used to be a closed wooded habitat full of monkeys and kudus and with a few Ardipithecus. And 6,000 fossils plus all of the invertebrates and all of the other isotopic data from soils and things like that lead up to the same conclusion. And this is a very different conclusion, I think, than most people expected of the earliest hominids, because many people thought that bipedality and the earliest hominids had evolved in more open savanna settings.
I think that what this gives us for Ardipithecus ramidus,
again, Yale University's Andrew Hill,
is an enormous amount of detail of what the animal looked like and the environments in which it lived. It may be as much as information gradually emerges as we know about, for example, Lucy and Australopithecus afarensis. The significance of this is that it's earlier in time, nearer the less common ancestor. And if we want to know what the less common ancestor was and to try and understand the forces that led to our divergence from a chimpanzee ancestor, this is much more relevant at the present time and is therefore in some ways more significant for that set of questions.
But, Hill says, that set of questions isn't resolved by Ardipithecus ramidus and the team's accompanying interpretation.
The interpretations that go along with it are very provoking. Some of them are undoubtedly true, I'm sure. Others will be topics of discussion for a good while. But the basic data, I think, is what really counts here.
This is where Ardipithecus ramidus is so important.
Again, scientist Ann Gibbons.
At 4.4 million years ago, Artie shows us a creature that was walking in an intermediate way, developing upright walking, but it's not fully modern yet, and it was living in the woods. It wasn't living in the open savanna, it wasn't using tools, and its brain was the size of a chimpanzee. So this is forcing wholesale rethinking about the models of why we began walking upright, why we went through social changes that set us apart from the other apes and sent us down the path toward humanness.
Finding this much of a fossilized hominid skeleton is extremely rare. Typically, scientists find just a few bones or a couple of teeth. But with Ardipithecus remedus, scientists have unearthed an enormous amount of data, providing what many researchers say is the best snapshot to date of a potential human ancestor. To see that snapshot for yourself, find papers or one-page summaries of all 11 articles in this week's Science. Online, please find the whole package of papers plus a video about Ardipithecus fossils and interpretations of them. You'll find it all at www.sciencemag.org/Ardipithecus. That's Ardipithecus. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, is re-examining its 2008 approval of Menaflex, an implant for injured knees, because of a concern that four members of Congress representing New Jersey and a former FDA commissioner unduly influenced the process. Here with more about it is Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
An FDA report said that the lawmakers persistently pressured agency managers to approve the device, and that Andrew von Eschenbach, the former commissioner, engaged in the process inappropriately. Menaflex was approved despite repeated and unanimous warnings from agency scientists that the device failed too often to be considered safe. This represents the first time the agency has publicly questioned the process behind one of its approvals or indicated that politics influenced a regulatory decision. Von Eschenbach and the lawmakers say they did not act improperly, and the producer of Menaflex, Regen Biologics, says the agency's characterization of the approval process is inaccurate. FDA Principal Deputy Commissioner Josh Sharfstein said that patients who have received Menaflex should wait until the agency reviews its approval of the product before taking any action. FDA has asked the Institute of Medicine of the U.S. National Academies to examine the agency's process for approving medical devices.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress.
I actually have no idea what the first ecological community was.
In our year-long series on evolution, Science's Eric Stockstead has our latest installment, his essay on the origins of community structure.
Probably something with simple cells. Who knows what the environment was? Charles Darwin's warm pond, perhaps. But what was going on in that first community was you had life somehow sustaining itself. It was impacted by temperature, by salinity. So it was making a living in some place. But as soon as there was more than one organism, as soon as there were many kinds of organisms, they were interacting. And that's one of the main things that community ecologists study.
In this thought experiment, the main interaction in this ecological community was competition?
Maybe. I mean, it could have been something called facilitation, where one organism changes the environment and helps other ones take hold or thrive. Or there could have been some kind of physical change in the early environment. I'm just making this up, but you could imagine a change in salinity maybe, or a change in CO2 levels in the ocean that might have altered acidity. Thought experiment, right, Rob?
Right.
I mean, we know very little about who was even there, let alone how they were interacting. But what ecologists have done is they've, by studying the modern world, they've identified types of interactions, factors, forces that presumably were in play as soon as you had a variety of organisms living on Earth.
Beyond competition and facilitation or the interactions with the environment, what else is at play here?
I mean, as we've said, you can divide them into two main groups. One is the impact of the physical environment and biological interactions. So in addition to competition and facilitation, other types of interactions include symbiosis, parasitism, mutualism, commensalism, herbivory, so when you eat plants, and predation.
Now, in your essay, you start out with the origins of the study of community ecology. Please give us a little bit of that history. Who were the key figures and what did they do?
I'm just trying to think where to start here. Probably not with Linnaeus. I mean, Linnaeus, and you think about his colleagues, they were cataloging life. They were figuring out how things differed from each other and what to call them and how they were related to each other. Community ecology began when people started to think about collections of organisms in the wild and why they're structured that way. So let's start with two people, one who was thinking more about the physical environment and one who we all know and love, who was thinking about organisms and their interactions. So Alexander von Humboldt, a Prussian naturalist born in the 18th century, but active really in the beginning of the 19th century, he went all over the world and studied plants predominantly where he found them. And he was lugging along a barometer so that he could tell the pressure and by that tell the elevation. So he was putting together a picture of how plants on mountains, for example, how the different types of plants change as you go up the mountain, as the temperature drops, as precipitation changes in different places, and started to see associations. So he figured out that you could see the same types of communities, be it a tropical forest with palms or more of a tundra with sedges and grasses, in different places in repeatable patterns due to physical environments. That work had a whole lot of influence on figuring out where communities are located on Earth. Charles Darwin, who we all know and love, a little later in the 19th century, did very important work studying the interactions of organisms. And even though the word ecology wasn't going to be coined for decades after the publication of his On the Origin of Species, modern ecologists look back and see Darwin already asking questions that they're still investigating today. So in one of his famous experiments, Darwin let a part of his lawn grow wild and studied how the composition of species, of grass species, plant species, there changed. So what he found was that 9 of the original 20 species in that plot disappeared. And that was because the more vigorous plants, in Darwin's term, outcompeted the less vigorous ones. So it was a pretty striking example of the force of competition, and one that he included in On the Origin of Species as a demonstration of how competition was involved in natural selection. Fast forward to the 1930s, in another really important experiment on competition, a Soviet microbiologist named Gauss put various species of paramecium into flasks with various kinds of food. And what he showed was that if 2 kinds of paramecium were in the same flask, and they preferred the same type of food, one would always drive the other one extinct. It would always outcompete it. So this led to a principle called competitive exclusion. And the idea was that 2 species wouldn't coexist in the wild if they really were doing the same thing, eating the same kind of food.
Since then, how have scientists expanded on or even dismissed early theories of the forces that govern ecological communities?
I think maybe the broadest way to answer that, sort of the bottom line, is they've recognized how complicated the world is. And what I mean by that is that many early theories were overarching. They had, to some extent, a simple, big idea. One example of that is that early in the 20th century, ecologists thinking about how communities changed through time came up with the idea that a similar community would always mature in the same way. They viewed it as kind of a superorganism that went through kind of phases of its life. So a forest would change through time in predictable ways. It might begin as a meadow, and then you would have saplings, and they would shade out the understory, et cetera, and you would always end up with the same kind of forest. And it's become clear that that may be true for some kinds of communities in some places, but it's not true everywhere. So ecologists now, I think there's less of a search for overarching laws or huge theories of everything. It's not that there aren't any big principles, but just I think that ecologists are realizing that there's no single principle that is really always useful in detailed ways all over the world. Ecologists are still trying to figure out in all of these different kinds of communities which of the forces like predation or competition are in play there and to what extent is one more dominant than the other.
Sounds like the field of community ecology is really fractionalized.
Well, community ecology means lots of different things, and people who are community ecologists examine communities with many different interests.
Do they have common goals beyond studying science for science's sake in studying ecological communities?
I think all of these areas of community ecology have the potential for making a difference in real-world decisions. For example, farm fields are ecological communities. Marine ecosystems are ecological communities. So the more ecologists know and understand about how these systems work naturally, the better they'll be able to do two things. One is manage them for human uses, food, fiber, and also to try to repair ecosystems, communities that humans have damaged. So there is a lot of practical benefit that can come out of the study of community ecology. But given how complex the natural world is and all of the unknowns in community ecology, it's probably going to be a while before community ecologists are able to do that.
That was Science's Eric Stockstead on his essay on the origins of community structure in this week's issue. You can find the whole series of Origins essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the upside of recessions. Dave, I'm skeptical.
Well, it does seem very counterintuitive. What this study is saying is that people are actually healthier during depressions and recessions, during periods basically of economic downturn, than they are when society is doing well economically.
What's the evidence or data for that?
Well, for this study, researchers looked at this period of 1920 to 1940. And what's significant about this period is it included the Great Depression, as well as a couple other small recessions, and also some periods of strong economic growth. So you have a sort of a nice mix of what's happening in the U.S. economy during this point. And what the researchers found, which was really surprising, was that during these recessions and during the Great Depression especially, mortality went down and life expectancy went up compared to periods during this time frame when the economy was doing well.
Now, it sounds like there might be, though, two different things going on. Maybe people act more unhealthily during good years. So I'm still with this is sounding counterintuitive.
Well, it does sound counterintuitive. One explanation for why this might be the case, though, is when society is doing better, people tend to be working a lot harder, which means people are under a lot more stress. There tends to be more smoking and drinking, especially during these periods associated with workplace habits. So you've got a situation where even though people are doing well financially, or even when the society is doing well financially, just the fact that people are engaged in these work-type stresses and associations can make them unhealthy.
So the upside of the recession is that you don't have the downsides of work.
Well, that seems to be the case, but the health effects weren't all positive for these depression and recession periods. Suicide, for example, went up, and that seems to make sense. Now, one other thing to consider about why these numbers might make sense, Rob, is that people tend to come together during recessions. At least that's what these researchers say. And when people have these strong social support networks, they just tend to do better. Studies have shown that the more family and friends you have to rely on, the healthier you tend to be. So that could be another explanation for this counterintuitive finding.
Now, are researchers saying that we can extrapolate this finding from these data back in the 20s through the 40s to the present day?
Well, Rob, what the researchers are saying overall is, yeah, that might be true. But what they're really trying to say is that you really can't use something like GDP or unemployment rate, these measures of economic downturn, to predict how society is doing health-wise, because sometimes the association is the exact opposite of what you'd expect.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from people coming together during periods of economic hardship to wolves and coyotes coming together to become a stronger species. This next story is about something called hybrid vigor.
I love the innuendo, Dave.
Well, Rob, hybrid vigor is this term scientists use to describe when you cross two different species and it makes a stronger species. They use this a lot with crops like corn. You cross maybe two varieties of corn that by themselves are not terribly hardy, say, but the offspring of these crosses can be very hardy. And this also happens in animals too, although often the effect is the opposite in animals. You cross, say, maybe two species of fish, and often the hybrid fish is not as strong as the two parent species are. But in terms of wolves and coyotes, it looks like actually crossing these two species actually does make a stronger species, just like it does with crops.
What's the evidence here?
Well, Rob, this story is about coyotes migrating eastward across North America. And it turns out that coyotes have been migrating for a long time now, but over the past 90 years, researchers have seen some unusual patterns. Coyotes have tended to take two paths. They've taken a northern path, which has taken them above the Great Lakes, and a southern path, which has taken them below the Great Lakes. But these two populations of coyotes seem to look a little bit different. The ones that have taken the northern path tend to be bigger. They tend to live in these more sort of foresty type regions, and they tend to be more successful where they are too. And they're spreading faster as well. So researchers have wondered, you know, what accounts for this? And one hypothesis has been, you know, there used to be wolves, especially in this northern region, and they're gone today. But perhaps some of these coyotes mated with wolves because even though they're different species, they're related. They're both canids.
But what about the southern species? I mean, have wolves been absent from that area for all the past 90 years?
Yeah, they have been. So these southern coyotes wouldn't have had the opportunity to mate with wolves, but it was just a hypothesis and researchers wanted to test this. So they spent 9 years collecting all sorts of, you know, tissue and pelts from hunters. They collected roadkill, they collected feces, a lot of stuff. And they ended up with DNA from nearly 700 coyotes. And with this vast amount of DNA from both the southern and the northern migrating coyotes, they were able to actually create these lineages where they could trace where these coyotes had come from. And what they noticed with the southern coyotes is that they looked very similar to their brethren that still live out west. So these coyotes really haven't changed much over the past century. But with the northern coyotes, they noticed two interesting things. First of all, there wasn't very much genetic diversity in these coyotes. And when you see very little genetic diversity, that means that you basically only started out with a few individuals, because the fewer individuals you have, the less genetic diversity you have. So that suggests that only a few individuals took this northern route compared to the southern route. But the more interesting thing they saw was wolf DNA in these coyotes' genomes.
So hypothesis confirmed.
Hypothesis confirmed. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense because wolves tend to be larger than coyotes. They also do better in these forested regions. They're better at catching prey. They have stronger jaws. They're better at doing a lot of things coyotes would need to be able to do to survive in these more northern latitudes. And so it makes sense that the coyotes would be at an advantage if they had mated with these wolves, which looks like what happened.
So it seems like today is filled with opposites of counterintuition here. The hybrid animals did better than the purebreds.
Exactly. And, you know, as we said earlier, this tends not to be the case for animals.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, to continue the theme of counterintuitive findings, this last story is about how one scientist's noise is another scientist's data.
In what context?
Well, this story has to do with GPS devices or global positioning systems. Well, scientists, it turns out, are not as enamored of GPS devices as the general public is. And that's because of this inherent noise that you and I don't really detect with GPS.
Is that because they need such more precise measurement than you and I do?
Exactly. I mean, you know, scientists, especially scientists studying the geology of the Earth, a lot of times they're looking at something called plate tectonics, and this is the movement of the Earth's crust. And, you know, even though we say movement, we're talking about very small movements here, millimeters of movement. And so you would say, well, you know, that's easy. Just, you know, put a GPS one place and put a GPS maybe someplace else and just track, you know, how these are moving over time. But it's not that easy. The problem has to do with how the GPSs receive their signals in the first place. GPSs receive their signals from satellites in space, which help them, you know, triangulate position and tell you where you are in the world. But the problem is that some of these signals actually hit the ground and then bounce up to the GPS antenna before hitting the GPS antenna directly. And this can cause this noise that we talked about earlier, and the noise can create distortion, which doesn't allow you to be very, you know, millimeter precise with your measurements. Now, that's not a problem for you and me, because if we're looking for a house in a building, a few millimeters here or there is not going to make a difference. But for scientists taking these really minute measurements, this noise is a big problem. And this is something we've been dealing with for 20 years, and they can still do these experiments, but it requires a lot of, you know, back calculation and this really painstaking analysis going through the data to factor out the noise so the researchers can take these precise measurements.
So who is using this noise? as data?
Well, nobody's been using this noise as data until now. What researchers did in this study was quite by accident. They were using GPS devices to see how sort of wet soil affects this echo that we're talking about. And they had placed a GPS receiver in a field in Boulder, Colorado. But what happened is when they had this GPS device in place, Boulder got struck with a couple really heavy snowstorms. So all the snow accumulated on the ground. And the snow also affects this echoing from the satellites. And the researchers said, I wonder if we can somehow figure out how deep the snow is by how much it's changing the echoes that we're observing in the GPS device.
So the delay, how long the signal takes to bounce back.
Exactly. And indeed, they found that when they went back through their data, they could precisely measure how much snow had fallen and how much snow was on the ground by how distorted these echoes were that were eventually reaching the GPS antenna after they struck the snow on the ground.
Now, you said they weren't looking for this in the first place. What are they going to do with it now that they know this?
Well, Rob, the way researchers measure snowfall right now is actually really cumbersome. They can do some satellite analysis from space, but it's really hard to do. They can also take direct measurements of snowpack, but obviously you don't want to be sending people to thousands of locations around the world with rulers or whatever measuring the amount of snow. What you have here is a potentially very easy way to measure snowfall anywhere in the world. Just put a GPS device down on a platform above the surface of the Earth. And in fact, the National Science Foundation already has over 1,000 GPS devices like this all over the world to measure plate tectonics and other things. So they're already in place. And you can now just start analyzing the data that these GPS devices are recording and measure snowfall. And that could be useful for everything from detecting weather patterns somewhere in the world to predicting floods, which can happen when snow melts. There's a lot of applications for this. And what's really neat is a lot of this technology is already in place. It's just a question of combing through the data.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a few stories. One about the fungus that ate the world. And another about the Ig Nobel Prizes. This is something we cover every year. These are sort of the alternative or funny Nobels. These are prizes given for research that's true, but kind of a little humorous. One story we covered in the past was about how lap dancers earn more tips when they're at the peak of their ovulation cycle. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we're looking to an important story this week about a project in the UK that's using DNA analysis to determine the ethnicity and nationality of people that are trying to seek asylum in the country. So very controversial story there. And there's a lot of other interesting posts on Insider. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to the July 17th review articles by Meltzoff et al., titled Foundations for a New Science of Learning, and Gabrielli, titled Dyslexia, a New Synergy Between Education and Cognitive Neuroscience. Mark Seidenberg writes in from the University of Wisconsin to remark on how little of the summarized research has made it into the education system.
Seidenberg writes, teachers are not exposed to this research as part of their training. I often speak with teachers who are surprised that a science of reading exists, not to mention a science of learning, linking, brain, and behavior. Educational theories rely on the work of a small number of psychologists, such as Lev Vygotsky and Jerome Bruner, whose research predates the modern era in cognitive neuroscience.
In the case of dyslexia, Seidenberg continues, many school systems do not even recognize that the condition exists. Parents of dyslexic children are routinely told that a child who can speak should be able to read, that the parents have not encouraged reading enough in the home, or that dyslexia reflects a medicalization of normal variation. The approximately 25% of American eighth graders who read below even the basic level includes many dyslexics who have not been identified in the schools and provided with appropriate remediation.
It is admirable, Seidenberg concludes, that the authors attempted to spell out the educational implications of the research. Whether the educators are prepared to act on this information or even understand it is another question. the institutional and ideological barriers to linking science and education are substantial, as are the costs to society. You can find Seidenberg's letter in the September 11th issue of Science.
Our next set of letters comes from the September 18th issue, and they're all about tenure, or guaranteed permanent employment as a professor, typically after a probationary period. These letters are in response to the May 29th Education Forum, titled Tenure and the Future of the University, by Dan Klassen of the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
This set of letters by Lester Sue of Johns Hopkins University, Sadruddin Cyrus Mousavi of Tulane University, Kenneth Gordon of Harrison College, as well as a response by the Education Forum author, Dan Klassen, bring up a number of arguments regarding tenure, as well as frame the debate in several ways.
For example, Kenneth Gordon of Harrison College writes, "The elitist view that tenured faculty are somehow above scrutiny, have a more altruistic vision of a larger good than others, and are the exclusive champions of education, is a view whose time has expired. It is time for the tenure system to expire as well, and to move forward with a system in which all faculty must prove themselves daily. This system works efficiently and fairly in other professions, and could work efficiently and fairly in the academic professions as well."
Lester Sue of Johns Hopkins University takes issue with the argument that universities aren't businesses. "It is ludicrous to suggest," Sue writes, "that running a university efficiently is possible without applying some hard-nosed concern for maximizing revenue and minimizing costs. Perhaps those committed to the continuance of the tenure system should consider that the definition of academic freedom need not encompass academic inactivity. If personnel decisions are left in the hands of faculty members, surely the professionalism mentioned by Klassen is sufficient to ensure the free speech and creativity of the university even without a tenure system."
Sadruddin Cyrus Mousavi of Tulane University proposes a change to the system to prioritize students. Mousavi writes, "Tenured and tenure-track faculty, as well as university administrators, need an incentive to meet student needs and to value those faculty who provide teaching services. A simple solution would be to tie a university's overhead rate on federal grants to the percentage of teaching services provided by tenured and tenure-track faculty. In such a system, a department delivering 75% of its teaching services with non-tenure-track faculty would receive only 25% of the normal overhead payment on the grants of its faculty."
You can read all the letters, including Klassen's response, in the September 18th issue.
Our final letter comes from the September 25th issue and is part of our Life in Science series. Tom Parsons from the U.S. Geological Survey writes about his setting two 1,000-kilo explosive charges on the bottom of Kenya's Lake Turkana. "The year was 1990, Parsons writes, "and these blasts would allow seismometers placed up and down remote parts of the East African Rift to record sound waves from explosions and measure the structure of crust being pulled apart. To collect accurate data, we had to detonate the explosions exactly on time."
"As an inexperienced graduate student," Parsons continues, "my job was to pilot the Zodiac raft laden with plastic explosives. Setting the charges on the glassy lake in the morning was easy. We just had to pitch the explosive sausages overboard into a big pile on the lake bottom. We cleverly marked the shot locations with buoys made from empty water jugs anchored with rocks."
"Returning in the afternoon," Parsons writes, "we found that the wind had stirred up the lake surface into considerable swells. Finding the small white buoys in a sea of whitecaps was challenging. We found the first of the two, attached the electrical line, reeled off 500 feet of cable, and detonated without incident. But now we had only 10 minutes to find the second, and the wind was fierce. After 9 minutes, we located the small jug. We had time to back off only about 100 feet before hitting the button. The result? Nothing."
Parsons continues, "what we didn't know was that the wind had blown the buoy about 100 feet away from the charge, dragging its inadequate anchor with it. That shift placed us directly above the explosives. So although we didn't see the plume of water come off the shot, it wasn't long before we felt it. The blast launched the Zodiac and crew into the air. I dangled from the outboard motor and landed back in the lake with the raft, but my two companions were flung into the water. Luckily, the blast had scared the crocodiles away."
Parsons concludes, Under a rain of dead tilapia and muddy water, we hauled back into the boat and started it up. Our only wounds were bruised bottoms from the force of the blast under us. We limped back to shore, where a Kenyan ministry official had come to keep tabs on us and our effects on the fish. We approached him sheepishly, but he only commented that the second blast had seemed much smaller than the first.
Parsons' letter is in the September 25th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the October 2nd, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Michael Torres for his help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.